is Seeking Delphi, episode number 19, The Future of Human Rejuvenation Therapy, featuring Aubrey de Grey. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. 2017 has been a year marked with mountains of technology news. Leading the way have been artificial intelligence and just about anything that Elon Musk does. Biotechnology has had somewhat fewer headlines, though the notion of slowing or even reversing human aging through artificial biotech means has had its share of attention. And while Ray Kurzweil continues to espouse immortality through merging one's consciousness into the computer cloud, researchers in the life sciences have other ideas for extending human longevity. I started 2017 with a two-part interview with David Wood, author of The Abolition of Aging. It provided an overview of the many efforts afoot to end aging and some discussion of the potential implications for society should it be achieved. One of the organizations in the forefront of this effort is the SENS Foundation. The acronym stands for Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence. It's a California-based 501(c)(3) nonprofit that spends its time, efforts, and money into researching potential therapies for reversing human aging, and in so doing, eliminating the many diseases of aging that afflict humanity. I recently had the opportunity to speak with the Foundation's Chief Science Officer and co-founder, Aubrey de Grey. Here's that interview. My guest today is Aubrey de Grey. He's the co-founder of the SENS Foundation and author of Ending Aging. Aubrey, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Aubrey, if you could start out with a little bit of your personal background. How did you get into this field, and what led you to found the SENS Foundation?
Sure. So I am quite a curiosity when it comes to the biology of aging, because my original area of expertise was not in that space. In fact, it wasn't in biology at all. I started out as a computer scientist. I realized at an early age that what I wanted to do with my life was to make a difference, to improve people's quality of life. And having discovered at the age of about 15 that I was a good programmer, I decided that the way I would do that would be to work on artificial intelligence research, which is, to my mind, a very important area that will relieve us of the irritation of having to spend so much of our time doing things that we wouldn't do unless we were being paid for them, essentially to eliminate work by making automation extremely comprehensive. And that occupied me very effectively for quite a long time. But during that period, when I was researching in that area, I met and shortly afterwards married a biologist who was a lot older than me. She was already a full professor at University of California, San Diego. And she accidentally taught me a lot of biology over the next couple of years, just a quick case of asking her what she did today every day. And gradually, and we're talking now the early 90s, I began to realize that we were never talking about aging. And this is something that was a huge revelation to me at many levels. I had always known that even though, the problem of work is a serious problem that I was already working to solve, nevertheless, that by far the most serious problem facing humanity was the problem of aging, because aging makes us sick and it kills us and all that kind of stuff. And I had completely assumed that everybody else saw the world that way too. So I had assumed that so strongly that I had never done the experiment of actually, raising it in conversation. But it turned out that no, actually, people didn't think that way. And in particular, my wife and other biologists that I was meeting didn't think that way. They thought instead that aging was this kind of rather tedious, rather uninteresting, unimportant phenomenon that we couldn't do anything about, and so we might as well not bother thinking about it. And I was utterly horrified by this. So the result was I was in a rather fortunate position of being able to switch fields, and that's what I did. I just basically spent a bunch of time creating a new career for myself. And here I am.
Aubrey, you wrote the book Ending Aging in 2008. At that time, you identified seven areas of intra and extracellular damage as the key causes of aging that would need to be repaired for effective rejuvenation to be achieved. So in the 9 years since, what has changed and how have things progressed? Are we where you thought we'd be? Have there been breakthroughs? Give us a 40,000-foot view of where we are now.
Yeah, thank you for asking, because really, you know, it's very important for me to emphasize that. So people often ask me, you know, when are you going to write a new book? You know, when are you going to update Ending Aging? And it's not a priority right now. And I could easily be presumed to be saying that it's not a priority simply because there hasn't been much progress, there's not much to say. But in fact, the reason why it's not a priority is completely the opposite of that. The reason it's not a priority is because, yes, there's been masses of progress, but it's been pretty much identically, pretty much exactly the progress that we were predicting in the book. So essentially, the plan is the same. The 7 points are still the 7 points. There's no problem number 8 or 9 that has come along and had to be added. And furthermore, the solutions that we discussed in the book are still the solutions. There's nothing that's come along that has made us have to revisit this and say, well, okay, the approach that we thought was going to be the right way to go is actually much harder than we had expected, and therefore we need something else. That none of that has happened. There have been some surprises, but they've all been good surprises in the form of shortcuts, basically, new technologies, new discoveries that have allowed us to pursue the same approaches, but more effectively, more rapidly than we otherwise thought. Now, there is one downside, though, which I also want to deal with here, which is way back then, in fact, a couple of years before I wrote that book, probably 2004, I started making predictions about the timeframes of how long this would all take. And of course, I was always making a lot of caveats. I was always emphasizing that the prediction of timeframes was very speculative, as it must necessarily be for any pioneering technology. However, the fact is we haven't hit those timeframes. I was saying that we would be, you know, we would be likely to reach we'd have at least a 50-50 probability of reaching a milestone that I specified and that I named robust mouse rejuvenation within 10 years from that point of around 2004. And we're not there yet. So, you know, what's gone wrong? I've just summarized the fact that the science hasn't gone wrong at all. So what has gone wrong? The answer is the money. The fact is that my predictions were always very strongly conditional on the ability to bring in funding that was sufficient so that the rate of progress would only be limited by the sheer difficulty of the technology, of the actual science. And in practice, I believe we've been going perhaps 3 times more slowly than that, simply because it's been so much more difficult than I had expected to attract the sufficient funding. And we're talking about pathetically small amounts of funding as well. That's the thing. You know, the budget of Sense Research Foundation is only $4 million per year. Million, not billion, million. It's insane for something that is the number one problem for humanity, the number one cause of suffering and death and so on. But there it is.
As it turns out, you mentioned something that is one of the 2 main milestones you cite for this research that I want to ask about. That would be robust mouse rejuvenation. There have been many stories over the last couple of years about scientists achieving some manner of life extension in mice. So based on what you just said, this clearly is not something you classify as robust. How do you classify that?
What I have defined robust mouse rejuvenation to be is taking mice that are already in middle age before anything has been done to them and doubling or trebling, I think I originally said trebling, their remaining lifespan. So what this means is you basically take mice, and first of all, they've also got to be normal mice, not mice that have some, you know, pre-existing problem that makes them short-lived. So mice that would typically live an average of 3 years, that's on the long side for mice. So you want to take those mice when they're already 2 years old and you have done nothing to them, nothing dietary, nothing pharmacological, nothing genetic. Okay, they're just normal mice. And then you throw a whole bunch of interventions at them. And normally they would on average live another year. You make them live another 3 years. That's the definition that I gave to be called robust mouse rejuvenation. Now, the things that have been happening recently have been exciting, but they're definitely not doing that. At the moment, we still can't extend the lifespan of mice by more than a couple of months by interventions that are only initiated at 2 years of age.
A second major concept you put forth in the book, also an important milestone of sorts, is something you call LEV, or longevity escape velocity. Just exactly what is that? Why is it important? And where are we in terms of progress?
All right. So let me talk about that a little bit. So longevity escape velocity, first of all, let me summarize the definition of that. So it all arises from the fact that progress buys time when you are doing rejuvenation. In other words, if let's talk about humans now. If we were to take someone who was 60 years old, and let's suppose that at some point in the future we were at the stage of rejuvenation technology whereby we could buy those people 30 additional years of life, so that we would take them at 60, we would throw a whole bunch of therapies at them that would rejuvenate them reasonably well so that they would not become biologically 60 again until they were chronologically 90. If we could do that, then the reason why they would become biologically 60 again at all is because the therapies are imperfect. There would be, you know, there's a huge number of different types of damage that happen. They fall into these seven categories, but still there's a large number of them, and some of them are just more difficult to mend than others. So we end up mending the easy stuff, and we can do that as often as we like. But eventually, the difficult stuff that the therapies don't work on will accumulate to the point where its overall abundance is the same as at 60 years old you had if you didn't fix, if you were not able to fix even the easy stuff. So that's why you become biologically 60 again. And the therapies no longer help. They are, you know, so you carry on getting biologically older after age 90. But because you've had those 30 years to wait before you get to be biologically 60 for the second time, you've had time to improve the therapies. And of course, improving means improving the comprehensiveness. It means getting to a point where you can fix some of the difficult damage. Not all, you know, maybe you'll never get to be able to fix 100% of the damage, but you'll be able to fix some of it, which means you will be able to re-rejuvenate the same people with what we might call Sense 2.0, so that they won't be biologically 60 for the third time until they're, let's say, 150. And so on. So the definition of longevity escape velocity is simply, it's the minimum rate at which we need to improve the comprehensiveness of the therapies in order to do what I just said, in order to stay one step ahead of the problem. And longevity escape velocity turns out to be a trivial thing to maintain. The rate of progress that we're talking about here in improving those that comprehensiveness is minute as compared to the rate of progress that we always see in other technologies historically, subsequent to the initial breakthrough that gets us over the initial fundamental hump. So the uncertainty of timeframes consists entirely of the question of how soon we will reach Sense 1.0, the original, you know, getting those initial 30 years. After that, game over. But so your question is, you know, how soon will we do that? And at the moment, my timeframes for that have, over the past 13 years since I started talking about timeframes, they have come down only by about 5 years, which is, you know, sad. But the reason, again, is entirely because of the lack of funding.
Aubrey, one of the things I think of when you talk about buying time with interim rejuvenation methods are some of the things out there that are being done to slow the aging process down first rather than reverse it. This is being done with pharmaceuticals like metformin and rapamycin. The former is in human clinical trials, the latter now being tested in dogs, or with supplements like NAD+. So what's your feeling about these compounds and the science behind them?
Yeah. So I'm all for this work. I think that it's very valuable in helping people to stay healthy longer. However, there is a very, very important feature of all of these supplements, which is very often swept under the carpet, especially by the researchers and, you know, companies that are working on them, of course, which is that they all work, or they're all hypothesized to work, by being what are often called calorie restriction mimetics. In other words, drugs that trick the body into thinking that it's not getting as many calories as it would like, even though it actually is getting as many calories as it would like. Now, the reason why such drugs are so interesting is because 80 years ago, it was established that if you feed a laboratory animal, like a mouse or a rat, less than it would like, then it will live longer than it would otherwise live. And that's a really important result. And by the 1970s, it had become the single, by far the single most well-studied phenomenon in the whole of gerontology. And it continues to be. People are very fascinated by this, and so they should be. And, of course, not eating as much as you would like is no fun. So if one could develop mimetics of this, drugs that would trick the body, then you get the best of both worlds. You get the longevity extension, and you also don't have the hunger. So that's wonderful. Except that there's a huge catch. And this is a catch that has been totally obvious and totally incontrovertibly the message of the available data for decades. So it is a fairly scandalous thing that it has been so swept under the carpet. The problem is that different species respond to different degrees to calorie restriction. And specifically, long-lived species respond less than short-lived species. So the world record for how much you can extend the life of a nematode worm that normally lives about 3 weeks with calorie restriction is about a factor of 5. And actually, you can do even better than that with genetic modifications, though it's unclear whether the factor of 5 really is the best you can do with just calorie restriction itself. But then if you go up, if you look at organisms that live a couple of years, like mice, you can't get a factor of 5. You can only get a factor of 1.5. You know, that's still plenty. You know, it's still very impressive, but it's definitely not 5. And unfortunately, this trend is, it persists if you go higher up the chain. So, for example, about 20 years ago, Purina did a very thorough and rigorous trial of calorie restriction in Labradors, which normally live about 11 years. And they got, lo and behold, about 10% increase in lifespan. Over the past 20-odd years, two groups in the U.S. have performed extraordinarily expensive and, time-consuming, obviously, experiments of calorie restriction on monkeys. And depending on how you interpret the data, they got maybe a couple of percent, of increase. And so, the prognosis for humans is not terribly good. And furthermore, this is not even surprising. If you look even slightly at the evolutionary basis of all of this, the reason why evolution has given us machinery that responds at all to calorie restriction by extending life, then you can see very easily that you would expect shorter-lived organisms to have a big response and long-lived organisms to have a small response, simply because in the wild, in the real world, famines are less frequent when they're longer. Long famines are less frequent than short famines. That immediately translates into the prediction that of what we see. And yet, here we are with all these drugs, which are selling terribly well, and people are terribly excited about them. Now, again, I want to emphasize, I'm fine with the fact that people are excited by them, because they do seem to keep people healthy. They are protective. But it is critical not to get to the extrapolation that these drugs are the fountain of youth. And that they really are the way to go, and that we will be able to make them better and make them extend life more, because it's bullshit. There's no way that that will ever happen. And if we make that mistake, if we think it will happen, of course, the problem is a distraction. It will demotivate us from paying proper attention and proper priority to the stuff that really will work, the rejuvenation stuff.
Let's talk about another issue here. One of the major recent biotech breakthroughs has been CRISPR-Cas9 and other forms of genetic editing. And two of the biggest stories connected to that breakthrough have been two individuals that have actually tested rejuvenation methods on themselves, Elizabeth Parrish of BioViva and Brian Hanley of Butterfly Sciences. What's your take on these efforts?
Well, so first of all, let me talk about gene targeting in general. You know, CRISPR is a fantastic breakthrough. When I was talking at the beginning about the surprises that we'd had and the good surprises, that's probably the single biggest one. Because the fact is, before CRISPR came along, there was very little that we could do. We had methods for gene targeting, for modifying the genome, but they were very laborious and expensive and so on, and it didn't seem that they were going to become any less so. So CRISPR was a huge revelation. There are things that CRISPR can't do. Specifically, it can't insert new genes into the genome. And we actually have a very important project that is designed to get around that limitation. But yes, basically, what we can do with CRISPR is, you know, things have got far easier and far cheaper. And of course, even, you know, the CRISPR itself is getting better all the time, getting more, you know, getting higher fidelity and so on. So that's wonderful. Now, as for the self-experimentation that Liz and Brian have done, you know, one can look at it in a whole bunch of ways. First of all, one can be, you know, curmudgeonly about it and say, well, okay, look, this is very unsafe, you know, God knows what's going to happen. If bad things happen, if these people die as a result of their therapy, it's going to set back the whole field some huge amount. You know, the same thing has happened, of course, in the past with gene therapy, for example, as a result of Jesse Gelsinger dying in the clinical trial. That's all true up to a point. But at the same time, we have to remember that self-experimentation is not new. It has a long and indeed very distinguished history in biology. J.B.S. Haldane, very, very famous and distinguished and respected British biologist from the 1930s, well, from the early part of the 20th century, you know, was rather famous for doing things to himself that I certainly wouldn't do. We have to acknowledge that it's double-edged. Certainly the scientific information that will come from the self-experimentation efforts is probably very limited, simply because it's an N of one. But on the other hand, the newsworthiness, you know, the high profile that arises, you know, the fact that people are talking about this, a discussion is actually occurring, has its own value. If people are not interested in something, it's very hard to get them to think about it. Whereas if they are interested, even for an unusual and rather tangential reason, you can actually educate them. And so, in a sense, people like Liz and Brian are helping me.
One final question here I want to give to you, Aubrey, and that is, I started this podcast at the beginning of the year with a two-part program with David Wood of London Futurist on his book, The Abolition of Aging. You may be familiar with it since he did mention you more than once in the book. And he had a forecast. He thought by 2040, there was a 50-50 chance of there being widely available, affordable rejuvenation therapy, though he didn't really define it to the level that you do. And I'm just wondering how you feel about that forecast right now. Is it over-optimistic? Is it well within reach if there's enough money? Or is it totally uncertain?
It's pretty much exactly the same as my prediction. That may not be a coincidence.
Aubrey, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with the research. And appropriately, in the words of an iconic science fiction character, live long and prosper.
Well, thank you. And thank you also for having me on the show. I always make it clear that people like yourself who are in a position to publicize this work are playing a huge role in getting this to speed up. Because the more information gets out there, whether it's interviewing me, whether it's having people along to speak at conferences, whatever, this kind of stuff raises the quality of debate, raises the level of understanding, and that is the absolute prerequisite for raising the amount of financial support for this work, which in turn is the absolute prerequisite for getting it done faster.
While the SENS Foundation continues to be one of the major sources of research into reversing the aging process, there are many others out there. Back in August, 23-year-old entrepreneur Laura Deming closed on several $1 million for her longevity fund, which will invest in for-profit biotech firms working on the senescence problem. Just recently, Dr. George Church of Harvard University announced that his own firm, Rejuvenate Bio, intends to initiate trials of age-reversible therapy in dogs by 2019. If successful, he hopes FDA approval of his canine procedure will raise the funds needed to begin human trials by 2022. Meanwhile, in current news, a researcher at Northwestern University says he has found what he's calling an anti-aging genetic mutation that is particularly common in one cohort of long-lived individuals. While another researcher at the UCL Institute for Healthy Aging in London says that inhibiting one particular enzyme might help extend human lifespan. But my favorite biotech story this past week had nothing to do with aging. The New York Times reported that scientists at the University of Rochester have been able to inject information directly into the prefrontal cortex of monkeys. If they'd like to try that on politicians, I have more than one candidate for them. Links to relevant stories in this program can be found on the corresponding Seeking Delphi webpage. And of course, you can subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes or Player FM and follow us on Facebook. Thanks for joining me. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.